Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 15th of December, 2021, and this is Reconstruction with me, David Taylor, and Phil Bishop from the Construction Index. And Phil, it's the last podcast of the year.
It is already. Doesn't time just fly?
I know, it's incredible.
It's our 80-something podcast.
Is it really?
I think so.
Goodness me.
We've done quite a bunch of these now.
All that hot air.
I tell a lie, it's our 90th.
Is it really? Good gracious.
It's our 90th podcast.
We should be celebrating, I suppose.
No, too early. Let's save it for 100th if we get
that
far.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's okay indeed. Well, it's nearly Christmas and it's been a busy old year, hasn't it, Phil? I thought it'd be a good idea if we looked back to see some of the stories that we've covered over the past year. And in fact, I've been going through the magazine. We only had, you know, a handful of issues this year because we've had to tighten our belts slightly. But looking back to
large handful, nonetheless.
A bountiful handful. But looking back to some of the early issues, seems like ages ago. I can't believe that it's less than a year that these features came out. But where should we start? I mean, I suppose we should start in January, seeing as that's the obvious thing. But we didn't publish the magazine in January. So what were the online news stories that broke at the beginning of the year?
The big story at the start of the year was, of course, the Brexit agreement, the Brexit deal.
Yeah,
boys got it done finally. that was the idea. Yeah, we started the year. The construction industry, obviously, in 2020 had ground to a halt with COVID and had got back working and figuring out how to operate, live with this wretched virus. And we started the year in a high degree of optimism. I think things were looking up. Work was, you know, had got back.
Yeah,
seemed to be getting back to normal. And the Brexit agreement, assuming you're not in Northern Ireland, was broadly welcomed. And everyone thought, oh, great, this will ensure supplies of goods, of materials, will be able to keep moving between mainland Europe and the UK. And it all looks quite promising.
Mm.
That's what we thought at the time. So that's how it started. But of course, I think the big theme of the year, if we park COVID to one side, I would say there are two themes of the year that recurred throughout. One was the whole issue of shortages.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
And the other, the back end of the year, was the COP26, or yeah, FLOP26, as the cynics call it. The build-up to COP26, the global intergovernmental environmental meeting. Throughout the year, all kinds of organisations, companies, associations were producing their roadmaps to net zero.
Yeah.
And they're all variations on a theme. And I think we can talk about that. There's not any individual thing new in that. But you and I have talked before on this podcast about the increasing popularity, if that's the right word,
yeah,
the increasing use of HOV, hydrotreated vegetable oil. We talked about hydrogen. If you remember, in August we had Bhuta Ratwal from
from Rise.
Rise Hydrogen, yep, former JCB executive, and he's the boss man of, I mean, Rise Hydrogen is Joe Bamford, one of Lord Bamford's sons. Rise Hydrogen is Joe Bamford's business, so there's a very heavy JCB tie up with the whole hydrogen story as well in this country. I mean, around the world, all sorts of people are promoting, pushing with hydrogen, and so the whole energy thing has been very much on the agenda this year.
I could jump in there because in May we published an article in the magazine by a chap called Dom DeVille, who's He is director of a sort of sustainability consultancy called Sancroft, which, as you may or may not know, is run by Lord Deben. Is it Deben or Deben? Better known as John Gummer.
John Selwyn Gummer.
Former Environment Secretary. And it was asking the question that we've actually raised several times throughout the year, which is carbon offsetting just a cheat's way to net zero? Because we get a lot of this, don't we, from people saying, oh, we've planted a million trees or something like that, so we're carbon neutral now. And some people even claiming to be carbon negative. And I thought that this actually was a timely reminder that carbon offsetting has a role to play, because it's a way of doing something good to atone for all the bad things you do environmentally. But it's not a solution in itself. You've got to do all the other stuff. You've got to reduce your use of energy and that kind of thing before you even start to think about offsetting.
Well, I've spoken before about offsetting. I understand that it's better to offset than not to offset, but I still think it's cheating. It's a bit like when you buy an aeroplane ticket. I haven't bought an aeroplane ticket for several years now, but you used to, last time I did it, there was a box that said, "Would you like to give us some more money to salve your conscience, and we'll plant a tree somewhere, so you can offset some of your carbon miles or whatever the jargon is." And while that's fabulous, I think I'd rather put a tenner in the hat of a homeless person or a big issue seller or give to the, you know, Cats Protection League or whatever. But I'd rather, if I'm going to salvage my conscience for the bad thing I'm doing, I'd rather give money to something more immediate and direct.
Concrete, yes, indeed.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree. So, yeah, that was, certainly it's been a constant theme throughout the year. And of course it did, as you say, it reached its climax with the COP26 conference. I mean, I could talk about all the things we've done in the magazine about offsetting and stuff like that, but you probably want to talk about other things newsworthy, don't you, Phil?
Well, there's an awful lot of news we could talk about this year. I did a quick calculation, and I reckon, broadly speaking, we've probably run about 3,000 different news items on the Construction Index website this year.
Really?
Any given year.
Wow.
It's something, you know, we average around a dozen news items a day, broadly speaking. Mm-hmm. It would certainly be close to 3,000. And I cannot, for the life of me, remember all of them. But as we mentioned, broad themes, net zero, recurring.
Yeah.
Shortages, recurring. It was shortage of materials. Shortage of skilled labour is a perennial.
Yes,
thing.
It is.
Always has been. Oh, not enough skilled people. You know, people don't want to work in construction anymore, as if they ever did. But the material shortages was new, and that created or helped to create rising inflation, which in turn made, particularly in the commercial sector, clients think, oh, hang on a minute, I'm going to pause this project because suddenly the costs are starting to not stack up. And so projects became delayed because of the inflation. And having started out all the graphs of industry growth looking quite good at the start of the year, by summer, they all started to not necessarily point downwards, although some did and occasionally they did, but slow. Growth definitely slowed. It was a slow old summer. Third quarter of the year was tricky. It picked up again to a certain extent in the fourth quarter. And the other shortage, of course, we haven't mentioned, is the whole lorry drivers thing. 100,000 lorry drivers, I think, was the figure that they said we were short of. And people blame Brexit, of course, but equally, it's been a failing of the road haulage industry for years that lorry drivers have been underpaid, underappreciated, given rubbish roadside facilities compared to what they get on mainland Europe, as I understand it. And we finally realise as a nation that actually lorry drivers are incredibly important people.
Well, they are. And I think we found out only in the last couple of weeks, wasn't it? I can't remember who did the research, but it's certainly a story that you posted online, which found that actually there's not just a shortage of migrant lorry drivers, the people who supposedly have kept the wheels turning in the UK until Brexit forced them out, but there's also a shortage of homegrown lorry drivers. It's not just the people from Europe who are leaving. There's just nobody. There's not enough people being recruited by the industry.
Well, that's not just lorry drivers. That's the same story for construction
sure.
as a whole,
yeah.
even.
Yeah.
I mean, construction as a whole, there was, oh, you know, Brexit's caused this. Well, that's not true. The outflow of non-UK or EU national construction workers over the past 2 years, the study was, or 1 year, is proportionately the same as the outflow of UK-born construction workers. So it's across
yeah.
the board, which
yeah.
suggests to me that while Brexit has slightly turned the tap off a ready pool of labour, it's not actually the cause of what's going on here.
No.
It's been going on for ages that the construction industry workforce is ageing.
Yeah.
And it is retiring quicker than it's being replenished at a macro level. I suppose that sort of segues onto the Construction Industry Training Board.
Ah, yes.
Who we used to look to keep us replenished with new recruits and new trainees. And the two big stories, I suppose, from the Construction Industry Training Board during the course of the year. One was early in the year, their U-turn on selling Bertram Newton and the other place in somewhere in Scotland. Forgive me, I can't remember where it is.
Inchinnan. I can't remember where that is. Is it near Glasgow? I think it is.
It must be up there. It must be near Glasgow, he says with absolutely no conviction. But the Construction Industry Training Board had been trying to sell. It has sold or agreed deals to sell other facilities that it has around the place, but these are the big ones. And it failed to find a suitable buyer for these training facilities and said, all right, we'll keep them, at least for the time being, and we're staying in the training business. And its whole strategy, of course, but it didn't want to stay in the training business. It didn't want to keep these facilities. We've had a couple of people from the Construction Industry Training Board on this podcast this year who've been very persuasive and articulate into how Construction Industry Training Board is getting its act together with the new strategy, notwithstanding the slight tacking with the wind, I think is how Peter Launer used a sailing analogy. But the other big issue, of course, for CITB this year was its consensus vote held over from last year, delayed from last year, whereby it's a process which it has to ask the construction industry, the companies that pay the levy, the training levy, do you still want to pay the levy? Do you still support this concept? And we've talked about this. The answer was a yes, but I think it's 66%,
yeah.
Which is a definite majority, but not in a, you know, a black-white binary vote. It's not overwhelming.
Yeah.
And we have a new chief executive at the Construction Industry Training Board, of course.
Mm.
Tim Balkin, is that his name?
That's right, yeah.
I've not spoken to him yet, but I look forward to doing so in due course, I suppose. And he's the man who came in about the same time as the levy result came in September, taking over from Sarah Beale as chief executive. And We'll see what change or continuity or whatever may happen under his watch in the next few years.
And the whole question of training and recruitment is always there, isn't it? It's an undercurrent all the time. And of course, the pressure is really on the industry now. As you just said, you know, we've got an aging workforce. We need more people. We need more people from different backgrounds. And so the whole process of recruiting and training people is in flux at the moment, really. And we've got to see how it settles down.
Well, one of the underlying issues relating to the whole training agenda is, and this is, again, rather like net zero, this is not a 2021 story. This has been a continuing story over the past however many years and will continue. It's a whole off-site construction, modern methods, modular and all of that. In the same way that we've talked about movements towards net zero, and it's said that off-site construction will help in the move towards net zero, the type of skills that we will need will change with the growth of off-site construction, factory building, modular building, making building components in factories indoors. And equally, the type of people that we will be bringing into construction or will need to bring into construction is changing, will change, whereby the computer experts, digital designers and so on become much more important, much more front and centre than your old traditional crane driver, brick layer, and so on. Although I take that back about that crane drivers. I think crane drivers are even more important.
Yes, because somebody's got to lift the role of the crane. Units.
Exactly, the role on the crane takes over. You know, a telehandler won't cut it anymore. You need something with a long boom to lift these big pieces up high.
That's right. I mean, does it worry you, Phil, that you know the development of these off-site methods, where basically, I mean, one of the big advantages of prefabrication, which is a phrase that people in the off-site industry don't usually use, but that's what it is. Does it worry you at all that it we'll see a dwindling, a loss of traditional skills like bricklaying, like steel fixing even? You know, those things which are essentially site-based skills. Is evolution making them extinct, do you think?
I don't think so. I do take your point. There is a movement, there is a drift, there is a tendency. But it's a bit like when talking pictures came along and people said, oh, the radio is dead, or when television came along, cinema is dead. No, it's all part of the big evolutionary mix.
I think you're right. Well, can I take this opportunity then in that case, because I set myself up, to plug a feature in the forthcoming issue of the magazine, which will be out after Christmas, I think, about another project which is underway to develop a very low carbon, very cheap, very affordable way of building homes.
Sounds perfect.
It does sound perfect, doesn't it? But it's if you like, it's the opposite side of the coin from off-site manufacturing, because it's very much on-site, and that's the use of, and this again is a local thing for me, it's the use of cob, which is a material made from mud and straw.
Hang on, you say it's made from mud and straw.
It is just mud and straw, isn't it? Yeah, you've got to do a little bit of... you've got to do something to transform into a building material, but not an awful lot. Usually just pour some water on it and then stamp on it with your welly boots. But it is a traditional way of building in all over the world.
Hang on. Sorry, David. Amazon delivery.
Oh, no.
Sorry.
That's all right. No, anyway, so I don't want to waste too much time talking about this, because obviously I want people to read the feature in the magazine when it comes out. But no, Plymouth University has joined up with some colleagues in France, and in fact they're networking all over the world with people to try and find a way of building with cob, mud in other words, that meets current building regulations. Because one of the problems with building a wall, even if it's 2 feet thick out of mud, is that it's not as warm as Part L of the building regulations would like it to be. So they've developed a new mix. I'm not going to give the secret away. You'll have to read the magazine in order to find that out. But I found that fascinating because it's incredibly low carbon way of building, because you dig the subsoil out of the ground, you mix it with straw or whatever natural fibre you've got around, and then you basically pile it up into walls and then put a roof on top. And it's been used, as I said, all over the world, that and various different variations, like adobe and rammed earth is another modification of it. And the professor at the university who spoke to me said that he went to visit a housing project recently in somewhere in South Devon, where a developer's building 45 homes, and he went there to get some subsoil to make his cob with. And the chap said, well, go and help yourself, mate. There's 10,000 tons of it piled up over there, because they'd cleared the site and piled up great berms of subsoil. And there was enough subsoil there to build 100 houses, and they're building 45 on this site.
Free material, no shortages, environmentally friendly.
Yeah. So
fantastic.
I don't know. Anyway, so there we are. That's my plug for the January issue of the magazine, out of the way.
You're looking forwards. We're meant to be looking backwards.
Yes, indeed. We should be looking backwards. You're right. What else, Phil? What else has grabbed your attention?
Well, I think we have to talk about HS2 briefly.
Yeah.
obviously, work started in 2020 officially. I mean, work's been going on for years in planning, in preparations, in advanced works and so on. Officially launched in 2020. But to my mind, the event which really signalled, we're going now, was the launch of the first tunnel boring machine at the southern portal of the Chilterns Tunnel in, I can't remember when that was. Was that May? Something like that.
You went to see it, didn't you?
May, June? I did. she had just, it was Florence, she had just set off. That's right, she started, it started in May, and her sister machine doing the other bore parallel to it set off about 6 weeks later, beginning of July. And somehow, it's a bit like when you've got a building, until the steelwork starts going up and you can see something happening, you know, it's just like diggers in a field shoveling earth around. You don't quite know what's going on. So the start of tunnelling for HS2 was a bit like the start of steelwork coming out of the ground. It's, we're going, we're really going. And at that time, as you will know, I was all gung-ho. I was an HS2 fan. Yep. You've always been an HS2 sceptic. but, of course, by the end of the year, the Leeds leg had been scrapped. The Birmingham to Leeds bit had been scrapped, which made a nonsense of the whole economics. I mean, it only stacked up as a project, HS2, if you built the full Y. There was never any rationale to being a high-speed link between London and Birmingham, especially as it doesn't peg into HS1, the Folkestone Channel Tunnel to London bit. I mean, the whole point of the high-speed rail network, it seems to me, is to tie into the European, mainland European network, and we decided not to do that. We thought, no, let's send, you know, people from Paris can go to King's Cross, but then they have to get off and get on a tube or crossrail or something and then go somewhere else to get on HS2 to Birmingham, which is a nonsense. I mean, it should all be linked through. I want to be able to get on a train in not just Leeds, in Glasgow, and go all the way through to whether it's Berlin or south of France or Barcelona. Yeah. That's what we should have been aiming for. We didn't. We gave up on that. But even without that, I was an HS2 fan anyway.
That's because you wanted to get up to Bradford quickly, wasn't it?
Well, Bradford's been even more shafted than Leeds, to be honest. I mean, it's there's no levelling up going on there, I'm afraid. So anyway, all my excitement about the launch of the tunnelling boring machines, you know, Florence and Cecilia getting going, HS2. And then being told that actually we're not going to do the Leeds leg. I'm afraid I've slightly gone off the boil.
Yeah, but didn't you see that coming? I mean, a lot of people did say that.
It had been leaked. Yeah. I mean, no one had told me, but I'd be reading it in the papers. But I wasn't going to report that there are rumours that, or you know, lobby corridors.
No.
Had been told this, that, or the other. But no, when it finally came, it wasn't a surprise.
No,
I just thought he might have put it on the back burner, or just I don't know. Slowed, I don't know.
But it's a fairly sort of typical watering down of a major infrastructure project, which tends to happen when governments respond to, you know, political necessities, I suppose, that, you know, the Chancellor taps the Prime Minister on the shoulder and says, sorry, I don't think we can afford this. And it's already sort of doubled in cost. So can we just sort of water it down a bit? And I think that's exactly what happened here. I mean, I think it was a miracle that the Channel Tunnel was ever built, but it didn't surprise me that the HS2 didn't come up to expectations, or won't come up to expectations now.
Speaking purely as a son of the West Riding, and I'm sure people in Birmingham will not appreciate this perspective, but to me, stopping HS2 at Birmingham and Manchester is a bit like digging the Channel Tunnel, starting in Sheraton and ending in Sark, or maybe Guernsey.
Yeah, I take your point. Still, of course, HS2 is providing plenty of jobs, isn't it? So, you know, something to be grateful for, I suppose.
I'm not a great believer in digging holes and filling them in again just to create jobs.
Well, no.
It has to be a higher purpose.
That I was playing devil's advocate there, because I think that's been one of my main criticisms of HS2. I felt that it was too much of a job creation scheme, and that the end product really wasn't going to deliver the value to the general population that people were telling us. I think it was good for the economy by providing lots of construction jobs, but that's about all you could say about it.
Should we move on to some of the names that we have lost and welcomed in 2021?
Yes.
Some of the new names that have emerged and old names, brands and companies that have gone by the way?
Yeah, well, there's always this process of consolidation, mergers and acquisitions, that kind of thing. And, of course, company failures. And there have been a few fairly high-profile ones throughout the year. And you've been monitoring this and chronicling the comings and goings, Phil. What do you think was the most... I don't know, the most significant name to leave the scene?
Oh, in terms of the industry, the biggest one was North Midland Construction, yeah. Or NMCN, as it had become in recent years. And we've talked about this on the podcast, and we had a fairly big piece in the magazine for you the other month, tracking the saga of it was unable to get its accounts in order, 2020 accounts in order. A rescue deal was in place. Financial White Knights were all set to take ownership of it, take majority ownership of it and reorganise it. But they couldn't, NMCN couldn't get its accounts out. And that was a big one. But the one I feel more emotionally, and maybe it's the North of England thing again, more emotionally affected by, slightly overstating it, but I think you know what I mean, was the demise of Cleveland Bridge.
Oh, yes.
Even though it's been under Saudi ownership for the past 20 years. This is a grand old name of British engineering, a name associated with the Humber Bridge and big bridges around the world. Mm. More recently, the Shard and Wembley Stadium. I mean, Cleveland Bridge is one of those names to be reckoned with in British construction history.
Oh yeah,
and so I can believe it went out. It was in financial difficulties, but I couldn't believe that no one wanted to at least buy the brand.
Yeah, that was the strange thing. Because as you say, I hate to use the word, but it was an iconic brand. And, the British steelwork industry is renowned throughout the world. You know, it's our steelwork industry is one of the greatest innovators in the sector. And Cleveland Bridge was, for a very long time, preeminent amongst them. So, yeah, you'd have thought that the brand would have a lot of value, just the name, apart from anything else. I don't know, were any jobs saved? Did people snap up parts of the business and, you know, take on people?
Yeah, good question. I don't know. We know that NMCN, I think, had many more employees, and that was mostly saved.
Yeah.
Head office-y type, admin-y type people. I'm not quite sure whether they all found new employment under new owners, but we reported that Galliford Tried bought the water contract, the water business. Kelt Bray bought the highways and infrastructure bit, and Sveller, this another new name, this Carlisle-based private equity outfit that was set up by former Stobart executives.
Yeah,
they took on the telecoms bit of NMCN, which I gather was quite a neat, profitable, discreet part of the business, and certainly the vast majority of the 1,700 or so employees of NMCN did get to keep their jobs.
Yeah,
I don't actually know what happened at Cleveland Bridge in terms of the jobs or any legacy businesses that may have emerged from it.
No, and neither do I. I mean, the British steelwork sector, I mean, British steel, the whole sort of steel industry, not just construction or steelwork, has been sort of atrophying, hasn't it, for years. Of course, we can buy our steel from somewhere else, probably China now, because I think they're now aren't they the world's biggest producer of steel? And then, in fact, there have been stories about the import of cheap Chinese steel actually undercutting domestic production. But of course, we don't have any steelwork producers in this country anymore, or steel producers rather.
So we've lost the name Cleveland Bridge, yeah, and North Midland Construction, NMCN. But some new names that came along this year: National Highways.
Oh, God. Yeah, we've talked about this before, haven't we? National Highways and the pointless rebranding of Highways England. Normally, when you get a name change like that, it's usually to try and divert attention from the stigma attached to the previous name. Think of Sellafield, which used to be Windscale, for example. So, did Highways England feel that perhaps his brand was sullied, you know, by the vandalism of filling in the old railway bridges. We've talked about that many times on the pod, and decided that it needed to change its name so people didn't associate it with that sort of activity anymore.
Or maybe it presages a land grab to Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland.
Maybe, yeah.
Because actually, of course, it's regional highways, not national
That's
highways.
That's true, yeah.
Because England is but a region of the United Kingdom, and let's not forget it.
Yeah.
Right, other mergers and acquisitions. Altrad bought RMD Quickform.
Yeah, that was quite a big deal.
That was just one. M Group Services, Morrison Utility Services, as was, private equity owned, I believe, M Group Services. They took over Skanska's UK highway maintenance and street lighting business, and created a new company called Milestones. So Milestones, a new outfit. Another new name, Equans, which is the new name for ENGIE's technical services bit. But Equans is going to come and go in short order because Breege is buying it. And I can't imagine Breege will keep the Equans name because it doesn't really have any value. The business has value, but the Equans brand has not been around long enough to have any value in it. So I'm sure that will become... Okay, are we Breege or Breege?
Well, I always sort of pronounce Breege. That's how I've always pronounced it anyway, but I'm no French speaker, so I wouldn't know. That's just my instinctive pronunciation.
On the subject of which, I was talking to someone who works for Vinci the other day, which I call Vinci, and I know some people call Vinci, and he was calling it Vinci. So maybe he'd only just joined, but I thought Vinci was clearly wrong.
I've had this conversation before, because you think you see Vinci and you think Leonardo da Vinci. It's a no-brainer. That's how you pronounce it. But it's not Italian like Leonardo. It's French. And French pronunciation should be Vinci. And I made the mistake of actually pronouncing it that way to somebody once. And they said, yeah, I know, but they say Vinci. So it's Vinci.
Well, I think it's probably Latin. It's Vinci.
Oh, yeah, it could be.
Veni, vidi, Vinci. I conquered.
Yes. Ah, that's your education showing through their film.
Bit militaristic to call it Vinci, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it probably is.
So I'll stick with Vinci.
Yeah.
So what else have we... just running through my list of companies that changed hand. Pimlico Palmers.
Oh, yes.
We don't write about them very often because they're a bit more in the sort of the B2C market than the, B2B construction world.
But a high-profile outfit anyway, yeah.
Yes, colourful Charlie Mullins. He sold it for reportedly £130 million, as the figures in the papers, and I'm told that the reports were broadly accurate, to a US home service company called Neighbourly, which is owned by the private equity giant KKR, Kohlberg, Kravis, I can't remember what the R stands for. So that's a good payout for Charlie Mullins.
Well, it is indeed. In fact, if you Google world's richest plumber, the name Charlie Mullins comes up immediately.
Oh, really?
He is officially the world's richest plumber.
Good for him.
Yeah, good for him. He's a colourful character, as you say, and quite... controversial in many ways. He was involved with it was all over whether or not this chap was an employee or a supplier. And I think it went all the way. Did it go to the Supreme Court? It certainly went to the High Court, and he lost in the end.
It was appealed. It went to the Court of Appeal, didn't it? Yes, it's the whole issue of when is an employee not an employee and all this sort of thing.
There's another topic which was bubbling under throughout the year, the IR35 tax status changes. That's something which we looked at as well in the magazine. It's one of those things about the construction industry, isn't it, that because the construction workforce tends to be fairly mobile due to the fact that construction sites come and go, loads of people who call themselves contractors are effectively de facto employees. And the HMRC and its predecessors have been trying to clamp down on what they see as tax abuse for generations, and they still haven't got there yet. But that's what IR35 is about. And that was basically what Charlie Mullins' legal case was about as well.
Talking about new names, a name which is not new but re-emerged, Tilbury Douglas.
Oh, yeah.
A name that had been away for 20 years. I never liked the name Interserve. It all sounded too contrived by half.
Yeah.
We are international and we serve you. It's a bit like Spud-you-like, isn't it? So Interserve or Spud-you-like, that name is now all but dead. I think it still exists as a legal entity in administration.
Probably.
But the it no longer has its facilities management businesses. That was sold, they were sold in 2020. So we have a proper construction company, Tilbury Douglas, which of course is the name that it used to be called. The coming together, created by the coming together of Tilbury Construction and R.M. Douglas.
Yeah. And I thought that was a really good news story, actually. I thought that, I mean, it makes me look terribly sort of reactionary. But, you know, we saw with Carillion, for example, what can happen to a construction company when it tries to spread itself too thinly and into, you know, into sectors that it shouldn't be meddling with really at all. And Interserve did that. You know, Interserve got itself into some hot water, didn't it? It had, you know, it was...
It failed. It went into administration, let's not forget.
And, you know, I think they learned their lesson and quickly backpedaled and said, no, we're a construction firm and we're called Tilbury Douglas. And I think, you know, hats off to them for making that decision. I think it was a very wise move.
One name which I hadn't heard before this year, but I was delighted to be introduced to, was Nancy Kerr.
Oh, yes.
Do you remember meeting Nancy Kerr on our podcast?
Yeah, indeed.
She's not a construction worker, not a civil engineer, she's a songwriter. But she was commissioned by the British Tunnelling Society to write a song to mark its 50th anniversary. A wonderful idea from the British Tunnelling Society, this, I thought.
Yeah.
And she got so into the groove of the commission that she came back not with one, but with five.
Yeah.
an EP called Tunnellers. And she was on our podcast.
She was.
April, episode 60, if you want to listen back to that. And we had her on with Dr. Benoit Jones from the British Tunnelling Society,
That's the guy
who actually commissioned her. And that was one of my favourite podcasts of the year, I think, and one of my favourite news stories of the year.
Yeah, it was good.
Little to do with construction, other than celebrating it.
Yeah. I mean, she's quite a big noise, I think, not maybe literally, actually, in the folk niche.
Oh, she's award-winning and highly acclaimed, but my knowledge of folk music doesn't get much beyond Joni Mitchell and Bob Dylan, so I'm not up to speed with the current folk scene. So, yes, I don't mean to say that she appeared from nowhere. She just...
No,
new
highly respected, highly respected, and I've listened to the songs and they're all great. I really like them. I mean, I wouldn't characterise myself as a great folk fan. I like a little bit of, you know, an Irish jig here and there, but yeah, I thought she did a great job. And as you say, she was a really good guest on the podcast. Really enjoyed having her on, and I thought that the British Tunnelling Association, I think, it's quite an inspired decision to get her to write a song, because it helped to establish them and raise their profile. Not that they needed establishing, they're already there. But yeah, that was great. I like that.
Another unusual guest we had on the podcast this year, not an unusual person, but slightly left field direction for us to take, not someone from the construction industry, was the theatre director, Nicholas Kent.
Oh, yes.
Yep. He staged in October... October and November, I think it was, the dramatisation, I think is the correct word, Value Engineering, Scenes from the Grenfell Inquiry. Now, we haven't mentioned Grenfell Tower. It's not a particular 2021 story, but it continues to rumble on. We did have the Building Safety Bill start its passage through Parliament this year, and lots of work continues to be done in the reforming the construction industry in the wake of the dreadful 2017 Grenfell Tower fire.
Yeah.
And the inquiry has rumbled on all year. And Nicholas Kent, working with the journalist, what's the journalist?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask
Richard
me that.
Richard Norton Taylor,
that's
name.
Right, yeah.
Richard Norton Taylor, a journalist, had not so much written the book, but
edited. Heavily edited.
Thousands of hours of testimony into a two and a half hour stage version for the theatre of the Grenfell Tower inquiry. And I finally, just before it closed, I finally managed to get to go see it.
Oh, did you?
I was slightly unsure how, after, you know, whether I would, wearing a mask in a little theatre, whether I'd start to feel a bit sort of itchy feet and, you know, restless, but not at all. I was absolutely gripped. It could have gone for another hour.
Wow.
In fact, to the extent to which my only criticism, there are testimonies and elements that I would have liked to have seen in it, which weren't in it. And I actually bought the book of the transcript, which is
oh right,
again,
okay, yeah,
edited extracts. And what I wanted to see, I noticed, was actually in the text, which you could buy after the event. So it was as if that they had decided that to get it down to a more reasonable running time, they had to pull out something. And it's a case of, what do we leave out? So maybe when it comes to the screen, they'll run the full longer version. So that was interesting. And as we go into 2022, of course, the inquiry will be continuing.
Yeah. I mean, Nicholas Kent has got, this is what he does. He virtually invented this sort of form of theatre production,
drama.
Didn't he? I can't remember. Drama, yes, drama. It is a drama. Drama seems to suggest that it's fictional, but of course this isn't fiction. It's entirely, I mean, because in fact all the dialogue is verbatim. He doesn't paraphrase or anything like that. He cuts it down to the bare bones, but he keeps in verbatim dialogue.
He did the same thing with the Stephen Lawrence Inquiry.
Stephen Lawrence Inquiry, something about Guantanamo Bay, various other things. And they're all sort of, they are scenes from inquiries. And I think it's fascinating because it's really a unique approach. It's like, you can read the news every day and get the press reports from each day of the of an inquiry and keep track of it like that. Or you can go and see something like this. And I think his skill is to distill out the essence of an inquiry. Because, of course, if you are only keeping a tiny proportion of what is said, you've got to make sure that that is coherent and that actually it doesn't distort the overall findings or the evidence which was produced. And I think that's the skill in doing what Nicholas Kent does, is to really, really condense something down and provide and present it in a really impactful way, you know. So, I mean, I haven't seen it, but it clearly
I don't entirely
you.
Disagree, but as a journalist, I think you're underestimating Richard Norton Taylor's input,
sure.
The man who actually did the editing, the whittling down,
yes,
of all the testimonies. Nicholas Kent makes it a dramatic. I was going to say dramatic spectacle. It was not spectacular. It was a courtroom in front of you. But as anyone who's seen decent courtroom dramas, fictional dramas on TV, knows that they are inherently, essentially, dramatic things to
yes,
watch.
Yes. Yeah.
So credit to both of them, I'd say.
Yeah. Indeed.
Dave, tell me about any stories that you've written or read this year to do with construction that you thought were horrifying or outrageous.
Oh well, I think you're provoking me here into getting on my high horse of my hobby horse, which is Highways England. Oh, sorry, National Highways. Oh no, it really did get under my skin. This story. This was the story because Highways England. We tend to think that they are in charge of building and maintaining our trunk roads and motorways, which of course they are, but they also have other responsibilities. And for some reason, somebody thought it was a good idea to make them responsible for looking after the very many disused railway tunnels and bridges dotted around all over the country. And you know, when Dr. Beeching closed a lot of the small railway lines back in the 1960s, he left behind a lot of structures which are valuable still to a lot of people locally in the area. If you go, cycle paths and routes and hiking routes, walking routes, that kind of thing. There are bridges and tunnels all over the country. There is one right down here in Devon, where I live, which make use of these structures. Our local one, the Tarka Trail, goes over various bridges and through various tunnels all over North Devon. Highways England's approach to maintaining these structures is, oh, that looks a bit dodgy. How much is it going to cost us to keep it standing? Oh, that's a lot of money. Tell you what, let's knock it down. Or, you know, if we can't knock it down because maybe there's a little road going over the bridge, we'll fill it up with cement and rubble. And that'll keep it standing so the road won't fall in. And that's what they've been doing. They've been going around infilling bridges. And
hang on. I'm going to have to slightly defend Highways England. This, they've only infilled one, as we know.
Yeah.
I only killed one person.
Well, I only...
No, the Enfield one. And you give the impression that they have plans to infill...
They have plans for them.
...dozens of them. And we're not talking about the Tarka Trail here. We're not talking about bridges under which, through which... existing cycleways.
No, that's true.
Go.
That's true.
These are places merely where there are hopes, aspirations for paths to go, or old heritage, hobby heritage railways might be able to. Two of them might be able to link up and use old railway lines. So there are these abandoned tracks of where a railway line used to be, but even where people might not go through them. That the wildlife uses it to get from one habitat to another.
It's a wildlife lane.
So I am absolutely on side that what they're proposing to do is pretty outrageous. But I think you're perhaps guilty of slightly over-egging it by suggesting they'd filled in hundreds of bridges and the Tarka Trail had been lost. That's not happened yet. And that's thanks to the HRE group of engineers.
That's true,
And activists who have been campaigning and... blowing the whistle, basically, on this whole issue.
Yeah,
I think Graham Bickerdike has done a sterling
job.
He has
indeed. Yeah, hats off to him. No, I do accept that. I think I only know of one, possibly two bridges which have been infilled so far, but there are plenty more which are earmarked for that sort of treatment. And Highways England, I think they've said, "Oh, we're pausing the programme or something like that, just to see."
Well, they didn't choose to; they were told to by ministers because of all the flak.
Yeah,
because Mr. Bickerdike kicked up such a stink.
Yeah,
and you just need to put that. One of my favourite readings is the letters pages of the New Civil Engineer. I don't know if it still exists in print anymore, that magazine, but I noticed that they. The reaction when they posted the same photograph that we did of the bridge in Cumbria, which had just had a whole cartload of
it was a mess.
Concrete and
it was a horrible mess.
It was cack and it was the sort of job I would do, frankly. Bodge, there you go, that'll do.
Yeah.
And let's name them. Jacobs was the consulting engineer.
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether Amker Giffen were the contractor on that job, but they certainly are involved heavily with the whole programme lined up for works. And this is the organ of the Institution of Civil Engineers. There's still people saying, I'm ashamed to be a civil engineer, to see what people have done in the name of civil engineering. This is, a blight on our profession.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be allowed. And when you get that kind of reaction from the profession, ministers just stepped in and said to Highways England, oi, stop that, you're getting flack. So it's on pause. But Highways England, they've only said it's on pause for the time being, but we're going to carry on doing all the shrub clearance and chopping down trees and so that when we can fill them in with concrete, we can get the trucks in and just pour the concrete and we're ready to go way hey. So they're still letting contracts.
Yeah, you just said in mitigation that, they... they're not infilling routes or bridges which are already in use, that the only ones which are at the moment might be in use. But what they're effectively doing is destroying any aspirations to use these. I mean, there are... We wrote about one particular steam railway somewhere. I cannot remember where it was. But they wanted to link up with another steam railway, and they could have done that. But Highways England said, well, we're going to fill that bridge in. So effectively, that's it. They can't do it. It was either, it might have been a cycle network, I can't remember. But there was, I think certainly there was one railway which had quite ambitious plans for linking up with a neighbour, and that's just not going to happen if this goes ahead. And I think there are loads of examples of this, because if you think about it, these routes, they provide access to the countryside for a lot of people, local people as well as people from towns and cities who want to go out and cycle around the countryside or go for walks and stuff like that. It has real amenity value. And I think rather than choke them off before they even have a chance to flourish, we should really be trying to encourage this sort of thing and provide people with more access to the countryside rather than say, this isn't worth anything. We're not going to maintain it any longer, because I think that's entirely wrong-headed.
But National Highways has no remit for country walks and country paths and wildlife and so on. It's not part of, and as we also learnt this year, it thinks it has no remit for road safety.
It's
barrister said in an inquest earlier this year that we have no duty of care to the motorists.
I know.
They come back and say, safety is our number one priority. No, it's not.
That is an even bigger scandal, isn't it, really? I know that he was speaking from a legal point of view. But when you're told that the organisation that is responsible for maintaining the trunk road network doesn't have any responsibility for road safety, it does make you wonder. OK, so Phil, you asked me what got my goat this year. What wound you up, if anything?
Well, I think I just touched on it. Highways England's barrister saying that they've got no responsibility for safety of motorists, which is outrageous and frankly wrong if you read other aspects of the legislation. But I don't want to dwell on the negative. I want to tell you what I think was the most positive, heartwarming one-off story of the year. There was lots of good news through the year, of course there was in amongst all the clouds, but my favorite we reported on the 23rd of March, it may have happened the day before, the Shrewsbury pickets, you may remember we've talked about before, finally, after nearly 50 years after being originally sentenced and found guilty of various charges of affray, intimidation, and unlawful assembly and so on, were finally, their conviction was overturned by the Court of Appeal. The judges basically said it was unsafe for all kinds of reasons, not least the political interference and the political conspiracy behind their conviction. Mm. We've talked about this before, I don't want to go at length. It all relates to the National Building Strike in 1972,
I think.
And a lot of the prominent, what has helped this stay in the public eye is one of the chaps jailed was Ricky Tomlinson, better known as Jim Royle in the Royal Family, or Bobby Grant in Brookside for older listeners. He was effectively blacklisted for construction industry, so he was out of the construction industry, but managed to forge a new career as an actor.
Yeah.
And a very successful one. A lot of the other Shrewsbury pickets were not so lucky. They basically, some of them, never worked again. And their lives were ruined by what happened. And the fact that they finally, the fact that it took so long is a sad thing, but the overturning of their convictions, I thought was something that warmed me.
Yeah. It makes you wonder, though, whether or not, it doesn't make you wonder, but I wonder whether or not the underlying attitudes that came to the surface with the Shrewsbury pickets and I can't imagine there being a construction national strike these days, but we've had what was the name of that organisation, blacklisting organisation?
Well, it was consulting association.
It was
the Economic League initially,
right?
The Economic League, and that became the Consulting Association, for which if you're going to talk about a corporate personality plant that's been affected the most successfully, I think you'd have to go to Sir Robert McAlpine, the company, because McAlpine were the prime movers behind the Economics League, behind Consulting Association. Others were involved, but members of the McAlpine family were the founding forefathers. But if you look at Sir Robert McAlpine now under Paul Hamer as chief executive, has become... I don't want to accuse it of being woke. That'd be construed as being an insult. But it is right up there with the
enlightened. I think is the
enlightened is the word. Yeah. Yes, has come a long way from its hairy arsed roots.
Yes, indeed. But we talk about the difficulty of recruiting enough people in the construction industry, and working conditions being perhaps one factor in that. There's been a long, you could almost call it a tradition, I suppose, but the industry relies on this sort of itinerant workforce of quasi self-employed labourers and tradesmen.
I think peripatetic is probably a better word than itinerant.
Yeah, okay.
You make them sound like they've got a knotted hanky on the end of a stick.
Peripatetic, yeah, okay. Well, you know what I mean. But I think that there's a problem with job security still in the industry. A lot of contractors, and when they do, and when contractors do directly employ their workforce, they make sure that you know about it because it's something to be proud of. A lot of construction firms, of course, don't, and they do rely on temporary employees on a, as I said, quasi self-employed basis or whatever. And we're getting back to the IR35 issue again, and just the way the industry is structured does facilitate that sort of blacklisting activity. If somebody says, just by word of mouth, they can send somebody a text and said, oh, we've had a bloke on site for the last 3 weeks, he's been an absolute bloody nightmare, you know, if he comes to you looking for a carpentry job or whatever it happens to be, I'd steer clear if I were you. And I think that's the attitude probably still exists out there.
Oh, but that to a certain extent, word of mouth. References in any job, you can't get a job without. You can some places, but many jobs require you to have a decent reference from your employer. And some employers will only too merrily give you a glowing reference just to get rid of you. but. If I'm looking for someone to do a job around the house and I go down the pub and say, anyone know a decent, you know, carpenter to sort out these shelves I've put up wonky, someone will go, oh, you know, get Bob. And someone else will go, oh, don't use Bob, he's dreadful.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that, so I won't use Bob because someone said he's dreadful.
Yeah.
Now, that's not a blacklist. That's just recruitment, yes, and you know.
Yeah, negative recommendation.
Let's not get onto the whole online business. But what was so pernicious about the Economics League and the Consulting Association was that it was an organised, orchestrated, written down, industry-led, led by industry leaders, blacklist. That's not the same as saying, I'm not going to employ them because they're a bit useless or they always turn up late.
This is it. It was about... again, it was about the workforce organising. The people they wanted to keep out were unionists. People wanted to not unionists, union activists, people who wanted to organise the workforce and get union recognition. And you know, the employers would do anything to avoid that. And that's what the blacklist is all about. But so finally, we've drawn a line underneath that.
Well, I'm delighted that we've ended our discussion of 2021 in 1972, David.
Well, you said you wanted to look back, so... yeah. Well, it's been an interesting year.
I think it's been a pretty rubbish year, I'm afraid to say. Yeah. And I'm looking forward to, I'm afraid, more of the same in 2023, but... Oh, no, 2022.
Yeah, get it right.
And I'm looking forward to much better things in 2022.
Yeah, well, let's hope so. I mean, there are some icebergs looming up on the horizon, as you say, the red diesel business and stuff like that. But, yeah, we'll just have to see how it goes. Is it time to pull that cracker and get into the Christmas spirit?
I think it is. hang on. Ready? Did that sound like a cracker?
Not really.
Well, I'm all organised for Christmas. I've done all my shopping, posted out my cards, all sorted, ready to roll, and I am looking forward to doing far too little except eating too much and lying around too much.
Good for you.
Are you going to be doing the same, David, or have you got
action plans? Well, unlike you, Phil, I've got a busy week next week because I haven't done any of my Christmas shopping. So those old Amazon parcels are going to be flying through the door before long.
Other retailers are available, folks.
They are indeed. We've got the decorations
up. Buy local.
We've got the decorations up, so we look festive, but I'm not yet in the spirit, I'm afraid. I've still got a magazine to get out by Friday, so you know, once that's over, come the weekend, I'll be able to start thinking about Christmas seriously.
And if you want to hear more about it or read my review of the year, it's online at theconstructionindex.co.uk, covering much of the ground that we've talked about. So you can see that there, and it will also be in the December issue of the magazine.
It will. Out in January, I think.
Out in January.
Well, actually, I don't know. I don't know. It's going to press. It's going to press at the end of this week. I don't know when it's going to be actually off the presses. Possibly it'll provide you with some interesting reading between Christmas and New Year.
Excellent. So that only remains for me to say to all of you, have a very Merry Christmas and a Bonnie New Year. And to you as well, David. Happy Christmas.
And to you, Phil. Cheers to that.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.